You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, can future events influence the past? Ken Wharton shares his time-twisting retrocausal view of reality.
In principle, it does seem that retrocausality could allow signaling into the past, i.e., same thing as learning about the future, or i.e., the same thing as time travel.
Wandering towards a goal as FQXI launches its new $40,000 essay contest.
Using science to tackle terrorism and to question our preconceptions about it with Peter Byrne.
Because it is really a perspectival issue. It depends on who you are as an observer of, say, a terrorist act, whether or not you consider it to be terrorism.
And a brief lesson on writing a popular physics bestseller with Carlo Rovelli.
Doing science is not a cold activity without passion, without emotion. You are totally happy when something happens, and you're amazed by the beauty of what you study or what you find.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Thank you for listening to the Foundational Questions Institute podcast. We'd also like to extend our gratitude once more to Carlo Rovelli and Colin Stewart, Peter Byrne and Ken Wharton for taking part in this edition.
And as always, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter at FQXI. And that's all we have time for today. And wait, what's going on? Haven't we just started the podcast? Why are we saying goodbye already? It's like the future is happening before the past. It's almost retrocausal.
Indeed, Brendan. That's because our first guest, or last guest, is physicist and FQXI member Ken Wharton of San Jose State University, who argues that reality is retrocausal at a fundamental level. In some sense, as he will elaborate, things that happen in the future do influence the past, because the universe can be thought of as a four-dimensional jigsaw in which the past and future exist all at once. I met up with Wharton at FQXI's 5th International Meeting back in Banff, Alberta, in August. We were chatting in a lounge, which is why, at points, you might hear some music playing in the background, along with some chatter. I began by asking Wharton to explain why physicists should take notice of such a seemingly wild idea in which time beats back and forth. Here we are at FQXI's 5th International Meeting in Banff, Alberta, and I'm sitting here with Ken Wharton of San Jose State University to ask him about something called retrocausality, which, as far as I can tell, is as exciting as it sounds. It's something about things that happen in the future affecting things in the past. I'm sure you'll untangle the subtleties of that as we talk. But first of all, it sounds insane. It sounds science fiction. It sounds like the kind of things we want to be true but maybe aren't. Why are serious physicists thinking about this? What kind of problems are there in physics that you need to kind of invoke retrocausality to address?
The problems in physics are in quantum physics, and there's something weird and counterintuitive going on in quantum physics. And the question is, which of our intuitions is wrong? And it pretty much comes down to either we're wrong that there's an underlying reality, we're wrong, perhaps, or perhaps we're wrong that things exist somewhere and some when, we're wrong about locality. But it's also possible we're wrong about causality. Maybe that is the intuition that's wrong. And the bit of evidence pointing in that direction is that as we've drilled down to smaller and smaller levels, we've discovered the laws of physics don't match our conception of time. They're time symmetric in a way that we wouldn't have expected until we discovered how everything works.
Okay, so I can't let you get away with saying that we might be wrong about whether there's a reality or whether there's causality and all of this kind of stuff without saying, give me an example of something that makes me call something that I hold dear through common sense and, you know, everyday experience into question.
The best example is quantum entanglement, but it's complicated, so I'm going to do a simpler example, which maybe isn't quite as strong, which is called the double slit experiment. And the double slit experiment, you send seemingly a single particle through a pair of slits. And if you look to see which slit it goes through, it always goes through one slit. If you look what happens after the slits, much after the slits, it looks like it went through both slits. It builds up this interference pattern. So this is a case where you're making a choice. You're making an intervention in the world. How are you going to measure this particle? Are you going to measure the first measurement? Did it go through one slit or the other? Or are you going to measure the second measurement? Did it build up this interference pattern? And whichever way you choose, you're always right. When you look, did it go through one slit? The answer is yes. It always went through one slit. When you look, did it go through two slits? The answer is yes. It always went through two slits. And so many people have noted it is as if the particle knows how you're going to measure it. It knows what's going to happen to it. And a lot of people don't like to take the next step. It's as if that's happening. The next step is to say, maybe it is really happening.
So, okay. So in this picture of retrocausality then, let's get to the bottom of exactly what that means. Are you saying, you know, you've given this double slit example, are you saying that the future is already written and so somehow the particles, the light, the photons, whatever in this experiment have access to knowing what's in the future because it's already happened? Or has the future not yet happened, but they're somehow clairvoyant? You know, what does retrocausality mean?
Well, there are two questions there we got to untangle. First, let's talk about the status of the future. And you're absolutely right, saying it hasn't happened yet. But in physics, most physicists who have looked at it conclude that the future is just as real as the past. You don't assign a different reality level to what's going to happen tomorrow. And one thing will happen tomorrow, I promise you, from what happened yesterday. They're just as real. Now, that is not the same as saying it's already written, because what you mean by that is probably, is it fated to occur regardless of what I do? And that's clearly not true. You can prove to yourself, you can make interventions in the world. I choose to intervene in the world a certain way, and I discover the world is correlated with my choice of intervention. And that's what we call causality. No matter how I choose to lift this napkin, when I make the choice to lift it, I discover it's lifted. And that is what we typically call causality. The example I just gave you is really the same thing. I'm choosing how to intervene in the world. I'm choosing how am I going to measure this particle. And I discover, however I choose, it's always correlated with what has just happened. And so if you go by that definition of causality, and you believe that you're uncovering a real property of this particle, did it go through one slit or two slits, almost by definition, your future choice is causing that past reality.
Okay, let me think about that for a moment. So it's your future choice that is affecting what the particle does, or is it the particle's future that's affecting your choice?
Excellent question. That comes down to how you define causality. Way back when, the philosopher Hume decided the way to tell which is the cause and which is the effect is whichever one happened first is the cause, and whichever one happens second is the effect, which is a perfectly good definition, unless you want to consider retrocausality, in which case you discover you're just ruling it out. You're not even allowing yourself to consider it. This interventionist account of causation, where an intervention is correlated with an effect, is a way that allows you to look at causation in both directions. So if you take the Humean perspective that the past always causes the future, you would conclude, I had no free will. The fact of the matter, whether the particle went through one slit or two slits, has determined my choice. And that's a very depressing point of view, I think. A much nicer point of view is that I have free choice coming from outside the system, in whatever sense that choice is free. And my choice is the cause, and it's the past event that's the effect.
Okay. So you've sort of presented this kind of time-twisting notion to explain what's happening in quantum experiments, but then you sort of said that a lot of physicists don't want to take that step and think about things in that manner. So what other options do they have that allow them to kind of reject this, and why are they wrong?
We'll find out who's wrong at some point. Way back when Newton first taught us how to do physics, and called it the system of the world, he taught us to use initial states and laws and evolve them to discover what would happen. And a lot of physicists see this as how the universe really works. The universe takes an initial state, it solves some equations, and spits out the future. And that's one way to look at it. But we have other tools in physics that don't follow that prescription. And the ones I have in mind are these things called action principles, where instead of starting at the beginning and sort of running the universe forward like a big computer program, you instead start with partial information at the beginning, partial information at the end, and solve the whole universe all at once, like an interlocking four-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. And physicists use this technique. It's called these Lagrangian techniques in all branches of physics, but most of them don't take it literally as how our universe might really work.
Okay, all right. So you've kind of presented this, and you're saying actually physicists are doing it. They're using the ideas perhaps implicitly without really thinking about what they're doing or appreciating or acknowledging what they're doing. But is there any way that we can test whether this is something that's literally happening or whether it is just this kind of mathematical trick that people are using? Is there any way to kind of solve this debate?
The problem with the test is you can't interpret the result of the test without some assumptions. Depending on what assumptions you make, you can test it. If you assume that everything in the universe lives in space and time, and you assume there's some reality, so you don't give up reality, you don't give up locality, and you say, I want to explain these entanglement experiments, the only realistic local interpretation of these entanglement experiments proves retrocausality. But most physicists say, well, let's make a different set of assumptions. Let's assume there's no retrocausality, and then the very same experiments prove non-locality. So basically what the experiments tell us is that if you're a realist about things, either nature is non-local or nature is sometimes retrocausal. But which one the experiments are telling us, we don't yet know how to tell.
Okay, so in some sense, it's a way of personal choice, you know, and what to believe about what you're seeing. You know that you have to give up something. You know that there's some weirdness happening, but it's kind of down to your personal taste, what you want to give up. But then let me ask you, and I can see that you're sort of itching to answer and to disagree with me here. Given the way that I've stated that, you can kind of argue with that now. Why does it even matter what you think, I suppose, is the question. What good does it do me if I decide to say, okay, well, retrocausality is the right thing to think? Can it take me forward? Can it help me solve other problems? Or is it just, you know, I can just think what I like, basically?
I'll answer that second question first. I think it's enormously important for the simple fact that we have these two branches of physics that don't talk to each other. We have general relativity, this beautiful theory of space and time that has withstood experimental tests for 100 years. We have particle physics and quantum field theory, another pillar of physics that also has withstood seemingly every experimental test. But these two theories don't talk to each other. So the goal in physics is to unify these two stories, somehow get one story that both of these fit into. And which way you answer this question basically determines how to go about that. If you think that the universe really is non-local, then general relativity is wrong, quantum mechanics is right, and we have to quantize gravity. But if you think the world is really retrocausal, and general relativity is right in the sense that things really do exist somewhere and some when, then instead of quantizing gravity, you want to start with gravity and space-time, and space-time the quanta. You want to take quantum phenomena and explain them back in a space-time framework. And so that is a crucial first decision point. And unless you explore both paths, you're possibly missing out on the right answer.
Okay, that's a good answer. So we just had a panel earlier talking about what exists. And, you know, one of the questions that came up was whether time exists. And I know that you had some things to say about that. But I guess in this retrocausal picture, I'm trying to work out, are you saying that time doesn't exist at a fundamental level? And that's why, you know, things can kind of move backwards and forwards and influence things in all sorts of directions. Or are you saying that time is so fundamental, it kind of has superpowers and, you know, it can work backwards and forwards?
Well, we should know not to just talk about time. We should know to talk about space-time. That's not always done. But if you take general relativity at face value, yes, space-time is kind of the manifold that everything lives on. That's reality. And my retrocausal perspective, space-time is absolutely real. We don't want to think about things sloshing back and forth in space-time, because what that does is it puts a fifth time dimension in, right? You're imagining things changing on a spatial axis that's supposed to represent time, and you have two times and it gets very messy. You want to kind of freeze it all like a big giant four-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. But suppose time exists now and space exists and all these things exist in space and time. In general relativity, that's all you need. Everything there exists. Everything that's not there doesn't exist. If you start from the premise that there's a wave function that's real, then you would be pushed away from that. You would say space and time have to be emergent. But the alternate perspective with retrocausality is that space and time can indeed be fundamental, and it's these apparent quantum phenomena that are emergent.
Well, now let me ask you the kind of science fiction question now, because you've kind of opened this door to retrocausality and causes in the future affecting the past or affecting now, or some sort of weird time twisty thing that I can't even articulate. But, you know, this is all at the kind of quantum particle level. But does this open the door to time travel? Does this open the door to, I don't know, seeing into the future or knowing what happens? You know, what can this allow on the level of our experience?
In principle, it does seem that retrocausality could allow signaling into the past, i.e. same thing as learning about the future, or i.e. the same thing as time travel. But you can ask yourself, well, is there any way to have retrocausality without allowing signaling to the past, without allowing paradox? And the only way to do it would be if, for some reason, what you were causing in the past was hidden, something that you couldn't see. And then you say, wait, isn't that amazing? Quantum mechanics tells us that there are things that we can't always measure. There are these uncertainty principles that says you can't always find out exactly what's going on in the classical description. And so really, quantum mechanics saves you from paradox, because the hidden things that you're causing in the past are hidden. You don't know about them until it's too late to make a paradox.
Wow. Okay. I think you've answered all of my questions there. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would like to say that when physicists have to make a choice and say which of our intuitions is wrong, we shouldn't go with our gut. When we just go with our gut and say, well, which intuition do I like better? All you're really asking is not which intuition is more likely true. You're asking which intuition is more strongly built into my brain, which intuition is more human. And that's not what we want to get at. We want an objective account of which of our intuitions are right. And so let's look at the evidence. Let's be good scientists. You say, I have intuitions about time. How well do they match up with what we actually know about time? And the answer is not really well. We don't expect time symmetry. We don't expect space and time to all be connected. We don't expect simultaneity to be subjective, and yet they are. So we know our intuitions about time are flawed to some extent. You can also ask the same questions about our intuitions about locality. Are they flawed? Well, back in the day, Newton introduced action at a distance to explain gravity, but he didn't really like it. But he did it anyway, and it took 300 years for Einstein to fix that. And now discover, wait, actually, there is an intermediary between gravitational bodies. And so really, we don't have as much reason, empirical physics reason, to doubt locality. And we do have a reasonable amount of reason to doubt our instincts about causality. And that is one of the things that makes me interested in pursuing this option.
That was Ken Wharton chatting with Zia. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, we have links to an essay on retrocausality that Wharton wrote for Nautilus, as well as some other time-twisting stories.
We'll also post a link to Wharton's winning essay, The Universe is Not a Computer, from the 2012 FQXI Essay Contest. This brings us neatly to the news that FQXI has just launched its latest essay contest on a topic that Wharton, with his retrocausal views, will enjoy, because it asks entrants to consider how we ended up here based on seemingly mindless mathematical and physical laws. Brendan, would you care to explain further?
Yes, I would care to explain. Or am I just saying random words that happen to sound like I care? This year's theme is wandering towards a goal. How can mindless mathematical laws give rise to aims and intentions? The contest wants you to look at the curious question of long-term, large-scale goals, aims, or intentions that arise in physical systems. That is, despite the way we usually think of physics in terms of small-scale, intention-less mathematical evolution. This isn't just about complex systems or biophysics or the definition of life, there are basic physics ideas at play here as well. Think of the action principle in Lagrangian dynamics or the path integral in quantum mechanics, where the story of what happens at one moment in time seems to depend on the entire story of the thing. This is our first contest in 2 years, and it is brought to you with our co-sponsors, the Peter and Patricia Gruber Foundation. As always, there are $40,000 in prizes, including a $10,000 first prize. The contest is open to everyone, and even if you don't write, you can read all the entries at our website for free. So go there for more details and full rules. That's fqxi.org/community/contest.
The deadline for entries is March the 3rd, 2017, so good luck.
And while we are talking about contests and awards, we must congratulate two FQXI members, string theorist Joe Polchinski at the University of California in Santa Barbara and Andrew Strominger at Harvard University, who were both awarded the $3 million Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics in December, which they will share with Kumaran Vafa, also at Harvard. The award citations list their numerous independent accomplishments, including discovering that string theory contains not just tiny strings that serve as elementary particles, but it also has higher dimensional membranes, or D-brains, that the string can be tethered to. They've also worked on holography. This is the idea that three-dimensional physics in a universe similar to our own could be described by the physics on a two-dimensional surface at the boundary of the universe. That raises the big question of whether we are just holographic projections.
And if that wasn't exciting enough, Polchinski was also rewarded for being one of the team that identified the black hole firewall paradox back in 2012. Now, we've chatted about this a lot on the podcast, and we'll have some useful links on the podcast page too, including a story that I wrote for Nature about the firewall paradox. But it comes down to this. Polchinski and co. discovered that either black holes are surrounded by a ring of high-energy particles, a firewall that violates the predictions of general relativity, or what we think we know about quantum theory is fundamentally wrong. Many FQXI members are working on resolving this puzzle, but so far, nobody has an answer, and nobody knows whether firewalls exist or not.
The LIGO collaboration was also given a special prize at the ceremony for their detection of gravitational waves produced by the merger from two black holes in February. Now, I don't want to spoil it for you, and I don't know for sure because it hasn't been recorded yet, but it's probably a safe bet that LIGO's discovery will make our list of the top physics stories of 2016, which will play on the next edition of the podcast.
Oh, and I wonder if this one's going to be a candidate for one of the best stories of 2016. I'm going to stick a link on the podcast page to a story that brings those two sets of prize winners, LIGO and firewalls, together. I recently spoke with Niyesh Afshordi, a cosmologist at the University of Waterloo, who has looked for hidden evidence of firewalls and other physics that contradicts general relativity in the LIGO gravitational wave data that's already been released. In particular, he's been looking for echoes of the wave signal that could indicate that general relativity breaks down at the event horizon. And, in what turned out to even be a surprise to him, he and his colleagues seem to have found tantalizing hints of those echoes. I've written this one up for Nature too, so I will post that article on the podcast page as well. And I should just add, I shared that article on our Twitter stream at FQXI, and I got back this rather lovely comment from Eric M. Gregerson saying, "General relativity is breaking down? Man, everything's gone to pieces this year." So, yes, exactly. It does sound like, even general relativity can't cope with the travesty that is 2016.
I can't follow that up. It's hard to follow that act.
I know. We should always get people on Twitter to write our scripts for us. They're much better than mine and yours.
That is dramatic stuff. We have one more FQXI member to congratulate. That's writer Peter Byrne, who has won a gold award in the 2016 Kavli Science Journalism Awards, one of the most prestigious prizes in science writing. He was recognized for a series of newspaper articles for the Point Reyes Light in California, in which he looked at an alleged breast cancer epidemic in upscale Marin County. Byrne found that widespread cancer screening, producing many false positives, was the likely cause of a feared cancer cluster in the county.
Byrne has also chatted with us on the podcast a number of times, usually in his capacity as biographer of Hugh Everett III, the father of the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. But he also attended FQXI's meeting in Banff to talk about the topic of his latest book on scientific efforts to understand and combat terrorism. I chatted with him at the meeting, where he explained why this issue raises a foundational question about the act of observation.
Well, the name of my talk was The Science of ISIS. And basically, it's about how theoretical sciences are used by intelligence agencies and in their private sector contractors and by the military to try and model terrorist groups so that they can make predictions about their behavior. The reason it fit into this Foundational Questions conference is because the theme of this conference is who is the observer? And it turns out that defining terrorism is much more difficult than people ordinarily believe because it is really a perspectival issue. It depends on who you are as an observer of, say, a terrorist act, whether or not you consider it to be terrorism. The cliche is that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, but actually psychologists have been studying terrorists for decades in the modern era, and one of the takeaway lessons is that terrorists are considered by psychologists to be rational actors, given their beliefs. Their actions, where they attack civilians who are generally targets that are standing in for more fundamental institutional targets like governments or corporations or entities that they can't actually attack directly, that these rational actors are acting in accord with a reasoned analysis of what their situation is. So from their observation, they're not committing acts of terrorism. In fact, peoples whose families are blown up by drones that are sent to attack terrorists in Afghanistan, suspected terrorists in Afghanistan or Iraq, consider the drones to be acts of terrorism. So that's how it fit into the conference. And what I talked about was how physics and evolutionary biology and psychology and network theory and just a whole range of theoretical sciences are now and have been for the last 15 or so years deployed to try and make these predictive models with very little success in one way and with some success in another way.
Well, that's just what I was going to ask you. So you're looking at this from very much the scientific perspective, but how useful has that been over the years? Or maybe another way of asking it is, could it have been more successful if some of this science had been taken more seriously earlier?
Well, there's two points to make here. One, in answer to your second point, is that unfortunately, even though the government, the United States government, has spent literally hundreds of billions of dollars commissioning studies by probably thousands of scientists to try and build these models, they pretty much don't listen to the results. And I'll give you an example. Using Twitter stream analysis, which there's a lot of social media type algorithms and methods by which Twitter streams and Facebooks and other social media are analyzed. Using that kind of analysis, scientists looked at the content of the Twitter stream from Iraq and Syria before the United States and its allies started bombing ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. And the Twitter stream from the jihadist camp identified the enemy as what they call the near enemy. That would be the local imams and mayors and maybe the Saudi nobility. And once the bomb started falling, the Twitter stream flipped over to identifying the enemy as the far enemy, which would be the Western powers. And following that, there was all these ISIS-inspired or ISIS-concocted and supervised attacks in Paris and Brussels and Orlando and San Bernardino and other places. And that was a kind of a retrodictive method where you looked at what the, because the Twitter stream is gobbled up and kept, you know, a record of it is kept, which you have to buy from like Twitter. But by looking at it retrodictively, you can make up methods by which you might be able to look at it predictively, so that since the Twitter stream can be analyzed in real time, and a number of people have been working on this, if you see a bump in the talk about who the targets should be, or and actually even the linguistic terms that are used in the Twitter stream, there have been studies that showed that the complexity of the use of language in Twitter streams in intercept the jihadist communications, or even in their public communications, gets much simpler right prior to an attack. So there's some predictive value and success, actually, I have to say, in predicting that there will be an attack, but that's different than saying where it will be or how it will happen. Nonetheless, it's valuable information. Unfortunately, the scientists have been telling the powers that be for many years now that the worst possible thing you can do to a group like ISIS, because there's, you know, been groups more or less like that in the past and there probably will be in the future, that the worst possible thing you can do is to do things like bomb them and kick the hornet's nest, as it were, because they're extremely adaptive, resilient, robust networks. And the term now we use is anti-fragile, which means that an attack can actually make a network stronger because it adapts and learns how to respond. The scientists have actually been telling, and I use that term broadly, the agencies that are in charge of counterterrorism, that the best thing to do with a group like ISIS would be to isolate it and let it devolve on its own. You know, you can do things like limit the amount of ability of it for it to gather funds from abroad or foreign recruits from abroad. But, you know, frankly, if you let ISIS set up its own state and to run it, it clearly will assume the responsibilities of a state and have to act like a state, and we've seen some evidence of that. And that makes it no longer a terrorist group, per se. There's no definition that fits that. And it brings into play a lot of different kinds of constraints, like they have to enter into trade with entities outside of it. And if they repress their own populations too much, people will rebel, or they'll kill everybody and then won't have a population to tax. So, you know, there's a huge logical argument to be made for containing terrorism rather than attacking it directly. And certainly we can see from what's been happening over the past 15 years that attacking it directly is a formula for failure that benefits only the corporations that sell the weaponry that is being used.
Let me take you back a bit. You were talking about, you know, analysis of sort of Twitter streams to kind of predict what might happen and how you can see a kind of change in sort of the language that's being used prior to an attack. I'm just wondering what sort of things can be done in response to that? Because I guess one of the worries is issues about overly policing innocent people.
Well, you basically just described what is being done. That's the status quo. Unfortunately, there is no strategic plan by the United States or any of the European governments to address this issue. It's all kind of a ad hoc, politically based, fear-motivated, money-driven system.
So let's talk a bit about the book that you're working on. It's called The Science of ISIS. Which types of scientists are you speaking to specifically, and what exactly are they doing? You gave the example of people who are kind of analyzing Twitter streams, but what kind of science is being done?
Well, it's really wide-ranging. I think there's about 20 or two dozen different scientific disciplines involved. I mean, evolutionary biology, for instance, is deep into it because, you know, in evolutionary biology, you look at stresses on a system and see how kind of alternative realities branch off from one another and how systems adapt. Network theory, computation is very much involved. For instance, identifying nodes in a network diagram of a terrorist group or a collection of terrorist groups enables you, in theory, to identify who the leaders might be or the power centers. And the United States has adapted this tactic of what they call decapitation, which is to try and identify nodes and then take them out with drone strikes. But it hasn't worked. Networks are so resilient that the leaders are replaced very quickly. The networks can disperse, they can relocate, they can cause terrorist acts to happen thousands of miles away that divert the resources away from attacking the terrorists on the ground where they are trying to establish a state, for instance. So there's that. There's anthropology has been used a great deal. Unfortunately, it's been used very badly. Around the time of the surge in 2008, the military hired a lot of anthropologists. They called them human terrain specialists. And they went to Iraq and went with SEAL teams on various missions, some assassinations and some trying to win the so-called hearts and minds of villagers in Afghanistan. And their information was being used by the intelligence community to target who they thought the potential leaders were, the nodes in the communities, which they would then assassinate. And very quickly, the Afghani villagers realized what was going on, and they killed an anthropologist, a woman, which stopped the program dead in its tracks, and then they had to rethink it. And they still want to use anthropology because in a lot of these areas you have tribal formations that have their own interests, and you need to understand what those interests are. And anthropology can be a very valuable tool to do it. But the American Anthropology Association has vehemently objected to the use of that. They say it's like using doctors to be spies, you know. And is there a way to do this without actually turning over actionable intelligence? Probably not.
So I know this is something that you're still working on, but do you have a sense yet of what the kind of the take-home message is or what it is the book is going to try to say?
I think the take-home message from everybody that I've talked to is that violence begets more violence, and that the answer to this problem is alleviating the actual grievances that people have in the Middle East against the Western corporate governments and militaries. And until and unless that's done, this program is going to grow exponentially.
Thanks to Peter Byrne for talking about his latest book, There with Zia. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, we are linking to some previous interviews with Byrne about Hugh Everett III and more about his Kavli-winning writing.
Now, since Byrne is still working on his terrorism book, you'll have to wait to read that one.
But if you're looking for gift ideas this holiday season, and you're one of the few people on the planet that doesn't already own a copy, then may we recommend the hugely popular 7 Brief Lessons on Physics by FQXI member Carlo Rovelli of the Center for Theoretical Physics in Marseille, France. This book summarizes some of the biggest ideas in physics in a poetic and accessible way. Reporter Colin Stewart spoke to Rovelli about how he created his international bestseller.
Carlo Rovelli's book, 7 Brief Lessons on Physics, has been a resounding success, becoming a global bestseller and getting glowing reviews around the world. But it's not your typical physics book. As its name suggests, it's short, just 80-odd pages. Small in size too, it could fit in your back pocket, meaning you could probably read it all during your morning commute. So I started my Skype conversation with Carlo by asking whether he deliberately strayed from the popular science norm.
Most popular science books are written for people who already like and love a topic. So they're full of details. They give more and more and more because the typical popular science reader wants more and more about this subject. Perhaps I could do the opposite. Write for people who don't care about that and just give them the core of the story, just the main idea. And I think it is possible. It's not a simplification. It's just giving the main result.
Not only is its format different from books on physics, so is its language. At times it is almost poetic in its description of the universe. Did this have anything to do with him being Italian, I wondered?
Yes, in part it's because I'm Italian. Other Italian physicists, of course, without willing to compare me to them, but have a similar style. If you read Galileo, it's very flourished. I guess the point is not flourishing, it's not adding flowers to the content. The point is not to hide the fact that when we study physics, our emotional system is deeply involved into that. Doing science, I think every scientist knows that doing science is not a cold activity without passion, without emotion. In fact, it's a full amount of passion when you do research. You get excited, you get depressed, you get angry with yourself, with what you cannot do. You are totally happy when something happens, and you're amazed by the beauty of what you study or what you find. And that's what drives many scientists. They're driven by the sense of beauty, of wonder, of interest. And I try to talk about that. Not because this is some addition to the core, because that's part of the story.
Are you surprised there's been such a smash hit?
Oh, I'm more than surprised. I'm astonished. I didn't expect this at all. I expected to sell a few thousand copies in Italy, and I would have been happy if there were 5 or 10,000 copies sold. I didn't at all expect such a reaction.
Why do you think people have reacted to it in the way that they have?
The seven lessons, that's the title. But in reality, it's a fake title because there are six lessons on physics. And then there is a seventh one in which I talk, it's not physics, it's just my own thinking and my own considerations about our role as human beings in the world. So I talk about what I think we are in nature. So it's, again, in the book they talk about science, but it comes back to us and offers a perspective which is very far from an irrational, religious, or transcendental perspective. It's very down to physics in a sense, but without, for this reason, being cold and without denying emotions, passions, motives, and so on.
So what's next? Are you going to write another book?
I have something in mind. I sort of go back and forth, keep changing. Of course, it's very hard to write a second book after you wrote a book which has become a worldwide bestseller, because you think whatever you write is not going to be to the level of the first. But on the other hand, there is a sort of dialogue that has started with a lot of people. I get hundreds and hundreds of mails of people reacting to my book, and it would be a pity just to run away from that. I don't want to stop being a scientist. I have projects which I care a lot, so I will have to divide my time wisely between doing science and writing.
That second book is indeed going to be tough because of the resounding success of this one. Carlo's right when he says that its appeal is in the human nature of it. Too often scientists live up to the cold, rational stereotype, and it's refreshing to read a physicist speak with an artist's flair. It's easy to see why it's been translated into 24 languages. That said, there isn't much here to appeal to someone who has read little of physics before, but then Carlo freely admits that was never his intention. But if it can engage with people who wouldn't normally pick up a science book and compel them to find out more about the power and beauty of the universe, then more power to him. I, for one, can't wait to see what he does next.
Thanks to Carlo Rovelli for chatting with reporter Colin Stewart. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can find a link to Rovelli's book. And on the community site, you'll also find out more about Rovelli's FQXI-funded research into loop quantum gravity, a theory that posits that space-time itself emerges from fundamental loops of energy.
That's all we have time for today, so thanks once more to Ken Wharton, Peter Byrne, Carlo Rovelli, and Colin Stewart. I'm getting a feeling of deja vu here.
And as always, you can email us at podcast@fqxi.org or reach us on Twitter @FQXI.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster. I'm off to the edge of a black hole to see if there's a firewall there.
And I'm going to wander mindlessly towards a retrocausal loop that will take me back to the beginning of the podcast.